I appreciate you coming, Voyle started. I didn't feel as though I had a choice. You folks have been relentless. Yes. It's very important to us. Mitch breathed deeply. Do you have any idea how confused and scared I am? I'm totally bewildered. I would like an explanation, sir. Mr. McDear, can I call you Mitch? Sure. Why not? Fine. Mitch, I am a man of very few words, and what I'm about to tell you will certainly shock you. You will be horrified. You may not believe me, but I assure you, it's all true. And with your help, we can save your life. Mitch braced himself and waited. Mitch, no lawyer has ever left your firm alive. Three have tried, and they were killed. Two were about to leave, and they died last summer. Once a lawyer joins Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, he never leaves, unless he retires and keeps his mouth shut. And by the time they retire, they are a part of the conspiracy and cannot talk. The firm has an extensive surveillance operation on the fifth floor. Your house and car are bugged. Your phones are tapped. Your desk and office are wired. Virtually every word you utter is heard and recorded on the fifth floor. They follow you, and sometimes your wife. They are here in Washington as we speak. You see, Mitch, the firm is more than a firm. It is a division of a very large business, a very profitable business, a very illegal business. The firm is not owned by the partners. Mitch turned and watched him closely. The director looked at the frozen pond as he spoke. You see, Mitch, the law firm of Bendini, Lambert, and Locke is owned by the Maralto crime family in Chicago. The mafia. The mob. They call the shots from up there. And that's why we're here. He touched Mitch firmly on the knee and stared at him from 6 inches away. It's mafia, Mitch, and illegal as hell. I don't believe it, he said, frozen with fear. His voice was weak and shrill. The director smiled. Yes, you do, Mitch. Yes, you do. You've been suspicious for some time now. That's why you talked to A. Banks in the Caymans. That's why you hired that sleazy investigator and got him killed by those boys on the fifth floor. You know the firm stinks, Mitch. Mitch leaned forward and rested his elbows on his knees. He stared at the ground between his shoes. I don't believe it, he mumbled weakly. As far as we can tell, about 25% of their clients, or I should say your clients, are legitimate. There are some very good lawyers in that firm, and they do tax and securities work for rich clients. It's a very good front. Most of the files you've worked on so far have been legit. That's how they operate. They bring in a new rookie, throw money at him, buy the BMW, the house, all that jazz. Wine and dine and go to the Caymans, and they work his ass off with what is really legitimate legal stuff. Real clients. Real lawyer stuff. That goes on for a few years, and the rookie doesn't suspect a thing, right? It's a great firm. Great bunch of guys. Plenty of money. Hey, everything's wonderful. Then after 5 or 6 years, when the money's really good, when they own your mortgage, when you have a wife and kids and everything is so secure, they drop the bomb and tell the truth. There's no way out. It's the mafia, Mitch. Those guys don't play games. They'll kill one of your children or your wife. They don't care. You're making more money than you could possibly make anywhere else. You're blackmailed because you've got a family that doesn't mean a damn thing to the mob, so what do you do, Mitch? You stay. You can't leave. If you stay, you make $1 million and retire young with your family intact. If you want to leave, you'll wind up with your picture on the wall in the first floor library. They're very persuasive. Mitch rubbed his temples and began shivering. Look, Mitch, I know you must have 1,000 questions. Okay, so I'll just keep talking and tell you what I know. The 5 dead lawyers all wanted out after they learned the truth. We never talked to the first 3 because, frankly, we knew nothing about the firm until 7 years ago. They've done an excellent job of staying quiet and leaving no trail. The first 3 just wanted out. Probably, so they got out. In coffins. Hodge and Kaczynski were different. They approached us, and over the course of a year, we had several meetings. They dropped the bomb on Kaczynski after he'd been there for 7 years. He told Hodge. They whispered between themselves for a year. Kaczynski was about to make partner and wanted out before that happened. So he and Hodge made the fatal decision to get out. They never suspected the first 3 were killed, or at least they never mentioned it to us. We sent Wayne Terrence to Memphis to bring them in. Terrence is an organized crime specialist from New York. He and the 2 were getting real close when that thing happened in the Caymans. These guys in Memphis are very good, Mitch. Don't ever forget that. They've got the money, and they hire the best. So after Hodge and Kaczynski were killed, I made the decision to get the firm. If we can bust that firm, we can indict every significant member of the Meralta family. There could be over 500 indictments. Tax evasion, laundering, racketeering, just whatever you want. It could destroy the Meralta family, and that would be the single most devastating blow to organized crime in the past 30 years. And Mitch, it's all in the files at the quiet little Bendini firm in Memphis. Why Memphis? Ah, good question. Who would suspect a small firm in Memphis, Tennessee? There's no mob activity down there. It's a quiet, lovely, peaceful city by the river. It could have been Durham or Topeka or Wichita Falls. But they chose Memphis. It's big enough, though, to hide a 40-man firm. Perfect choice. You mean every partner? His words trailed off. Yes, every partner knows and plays by the rules. We suspect that most of the associates know, but it's hard to tell. There's so much we don't know, Mitch. I can't explain how the firm operates and who's in on it. But we strongly suspect a lot of criminal activity down there. Such as? Tax fraud. They do all the tax work for the Meralta bunch. They file nice, neat, proper-looking tax returns each year and report a fraction of the income. They launder money like crazy. They set up legitimate businesses with dirty money. That bank in St. Louis. Big client. What is it? Commercial Guarantee. Right, that's it. Mafia owned. Firm does all its legal work. Meralto takes in an estimated $300 million a year from gambling, dope, numbers, everything. All cash, right? Most of it goes to those banks in the Caymans. How does it move from Chicago to the islands? Any idea? The plane, we suspect. That gold-plated Lear you flew up here on runs about once a week to Georgetown. Mitch sat straight and watched Terence, who was out of hearing range and standing now on the footbridge. "So why don't you get your indictments and bust it all up?" "We can't." "We will, I assure you. I've assigned 5 agents to the project in Memphis and 3 here in Washington." "I'll get them, Mitch. I promise you. But we must have someone from the inside. They are very smart. They have plenty of money. They're extremely careful and they don't make mistakes. I am convinced that we must have help from you or another member of the firm. We need copies of files, copies of bank records, copies of 1,000,000 documents that can only come from within. It's impossible otherwise. And I have been chosen. And you have been chosen. If you decline, then you can go on your way and make plenty of money and, in general, be a successful lawyer. But we will keep trying. We'll wait for the next new associate and try to pick him off. And if that doesn't work, we'll move in on one of the older associates. One with courage and morals and guts to do what's right. We'll find our man one day, Mitch. And when that happens, we'll indict you along with all the rest and ship your rich and successful ass off to prison. It will happen, son. Believe me. At that moment, at that place and time, Mitch believed him. "Mr. Voiles, I'm cold. Could we walk around?" "Sure, Mitch." They walked slowly to the sidewalk and headed in the direction of the Vietnam Memorial. Mitch glanced over his shoulder. Terence and the other agent were following at a distance. Another agent in dark brown sat suspiciously on a park bench up the sidewalk. "Who was Anthony Bendini?" Mitch asked. "He married a Maralto in 1930, the old man's son-in-law. They had an operation in Philadelphia back then, and he was stationed there. Then in the 40s, for some reason, he was sent to Memphis to set up shop. He was a very good lawyer, though, from what we know." 1,000 questions flooded his brain and fought to be asked. He tried to appear calm, under control, skeptical. "What about Oliver Lambert?" "A prince of a guy. The perfect senior partner, who just happened to know all about Hodge and Kaczynski and the plans to eliminate them. The next time you see Mr. Lambert around the office, try to remember that he is a cold-blooded murderer. Of course, he has no choice. If he didn't cooperate, they'd find him floating somewhere. They're all like that, Mitch. They started off just like you. Young, bright, ambitious. Then suddenly one day they were in over their heads with no place to go. So they play along, work hard, do a hell of a job putting up a good front and looking like a real respectable little law firm. Each year or so they recruit a bright young law student from a poor background, no family money, with a wife who wants babies, and they throw money at him and sign him up." Mitch thought of the money, the excessive salary from a small firm in Memphis, and the car and low-interest mortgage. He was headed for Wall Street and had been sidetracked by the money. Only the money. "What about Nathan Locke?" The director smiled. "Locke is another story. He grew up a poor kid in Chicago and was running errands for old man Maralto by the time he was 10. He's been a hood all his life. Scratched his way through law school, and the old man sent him south to work with Anthony Bendini in the white-collar crime division of the family. He was always a favorite of the old man." "When did Maralto die?" 11 years ago, at the age of 88. He has two slimy sons, Mickey the Mouth and Joey the Priest. Mickey lives in Las Vegas and has a limited role in the family business. Joey is the boss. The sidewalk reached an intersection with another one. In the distance to the left, the Washington Monument reached upward in the bitter wind. To the right, the walkway led to the wall. A handful of people were now staring at it, searching for the names of sons and husbands and friends. Mitch headed for the wall. They walked slowly. Mitch spoke softly. "I don't understand how the firm can do so much illegal work and keep it quiet. That place is full of secretaries and clerks and paralegals." "Good point, and one I cannot fully answer. We think it operates as two firms. One is legitimate, with the new associates, most of the secretaries, and support people. Then the senior associates and partners do the dirty work. Hodge and Kaczynski were about to give us plenty of information, but they never made it. Hodge told Terrence once that there was a group of paralegals in the basement he knew little about. They worked directly for Locke and Milligan and McKnight and a few other partners, and no one was really sure what they did. Secretaries know everything, and we think that some of them are probably in on it. If so, I'm sure they're well paid and too scared to talk. Think about it, Mitch. If you work there making great money with great benefits, and you know that if you ask too many questions or start talking, you wind up in the river, what do? You keep your mouth shut and take the money. They stopped at the beginning of the wall, at a point where the black granite began at ground level and started its run of 246 feet until it angled into the second row of identical panels. 60 feet away, an elderly couple stared at the wall and cried softly. They huddled together for warmth and strength. The mother bent down and laid a framed black-and-white photo at the base of the wall. The father laid a shoebox full of high school memorabilia next to the photo. Football programs, class pictures, love letters, key rings, and a gold chain. They cried louder. Mitch turned his back to the wall and looked at the Washington Monument. The director watched his eyes. "So what am I supposed to do?" Mitch asked. "First of all, keep your mouth shut. If you start asking questions, your life could be in danger. Your wife's also. Don't have any kids in the near future. They're easy targets. It's best to play dumb, as if everything is wonderful and you still plan to be the world's greatest lawyer. Second, you must make a decision. Not now, but soon. You must decide if you will cooperate or not. If you choose to help us, we will, of course, make it worth your while. If you choose not to, then we will continue to watch the firm until we decide to approach another associate. As I said, one of these days we'll find someone with guts and nail those bastards. And the Meralto crime family, as we know it, will cease to exist. We'll protect you, Mitch, and you'll never have to work again in your life." "What life? I'll live in fear forever, if I live. I've heard stories of witnesses the FBI has supposedly hidden. 10 years later, the car explodes as they back out the driveway to go to work. The body is scattered over 3 blocks. The mob never forgets, Director. You know that." "They never forget, Mitch. But I promise you, you and your wife will be protected." The director looked at his watch. "You'd better get back, or they'll be suspicious. Terrence will be in touch. Trust him, Mitch. He's trying to save your life. He has full authority to act on my behalf. If he tells you something, it's coming from me. He can negotiate. Negotiate what? Terms, Mitch. What we give you in return for what you give us. We want the Meralto family, and you can deliver. You name your price, and this government, working through the FBI, will deliver. Within reason, of course. And that's coming from me, Mitch. They walked slowly along the wall and stopped by the agent in the wheelchair. Voiles stuck out his hand. Look, there's a taxi waiting where you came in, number 1073. Same driver. You'd better leave now. We will not meet again, but Terence will contact you in a couple of weeks. Please think about what I said. Don't convince yourself the firm is invincible and can operate forever, because I will not allow it. We will make a move in the near future, I promise that. I just hope you're on our side. I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. Terence has the game plan. A lot will depend upon you and what you learn once you're committed. Committed. That's the word, Mitch. Once you commit, there's no turning back. They can be more ruthless than any organization on Earth. Why did you pick me? We had to pick someone. No, that's not true. We picked you because you have the guts to walk away from it. You have no family except a wife. No ties, no roots. You've been hurt by every person you ever cared for, except Abby. You raised yourself, and in doing so became self-reliant and independent. You don't need the firm. You can leave it. You're hardened and calloused beyond your years. And you're smart enough to pull it off, Mitch. You won't get caught. That's why we picked you. Good day, Mitch. Thanks for coming. You'd better get back. Voiles turned and walked quickly away. Terence waited at the end of the wall and gave Mitch a quick salute, as if to say, "So long, for now." Chapter 20. After making the obligatory stop in Atlanta, the Delta DC-9 landed in a cold rain at Memphis International. It parked at Gate 19, and the tightly packed crowd of business travelers quickly disembarked. Mitch carried only his briefcase and an Esquire. He saw Abby waiting near the payphones and moved quickly through the pack. He threw the briefcase and magazine against the wall and bear-hugged her. The 4 days in Washington seemed like a month. They kissed again and again and whispered softly. "How about a date?" he asked. "I've got dinner on the table and wine in the cooler," she said. They held hands and walked through the mob, pushing down the concourse in the general direction of the luggage pickup. He spoke quietly. "Well, we need to talk, and we can't do it at home." She gripped his hand tighter.
"Oh?"
"Yes. In fact, we need to have a long talk."
"What happened?"
"It'll take a while."
"Why am I suddenly nervous?"
"Just keep cool. Keep smiling. They're watching." She smiled and glanced to her right.
"Who's watching?"
"I'll explain in just a moment." Mitch suddenly pulled her to his left. They cut through the wave of human traffic and darted into a dark, crowded lounge full of businessmen drinking and watching the television above the bar and waiting for their flights. A small round table covered with empty beer mugs had just been vacated, and they sat with their backs to the wall and a view of the bar in the concourse. They sat close together, within 3 feet of another table. Mitch stared at the door and analyzed every face that walked in.
How long are we going to be here? She asked.
Why? She slid out of the full-length fox and folded it on the chair across the table.
What exactly are you looking for?
Just keep smiling for a moment. Pretend you really missed me. Here, give me a kiss. He pecked her on the lips, and they smiled into each other's eyes. He kissed her cheek and returned to the door. A waiter rushed to the table and cleaned it off. They ordered wine. She smiled at him.
How was your trip?
Boring. We were in class 8 hours a day for 4 days. After the first day, I hardly left the hotel. They crammed 6 months' worth of tax revisions into 32 hours.
Did you get to sightsee?
He smiled and looked dreamily at her. I missed you, Abby. More than I've ever missed anyone in my life. I love you. I think you're gorgeous, absolutely stunning. I do not enjoy traveling alone and waking up in a strange hotel bed without you. And I have something horrible to tell you. She stopped, smiling. He slowly looked around the room. They were 3 deep at the bar and yelling at the Knicks-Lakers game. The lounge was suddenly louder. I'll tell you about it, he said. But there's a very good chance someone is in here right now watching us. They cannot hear, but they can observe. Just smile occasionally, although it will be hard. The wine arrived, and Mitch began his story. He left nothing out. She spoke only once. He told her about Anthony Bendini and Old Man Meralto, and then Nathan Locke growing up in Chicago and Oliver Lambert and the boys on the 5th floor. Abby nervously sipped her wine and tried valiantly to appear as the normal, loving wife who missed her husband and was now enjoying immensely his recollection of the tax seminar. She watched the people at the bar, sipped a little, and occasionally grinned at Mitch as he told of the money laundering and the murdered lawyers. Her body ached with fear. Her breath was wildly irregular. But she listened and pretended. The waiter brought more wine as the crowd thinned. An hour after he started, Mitch finished in a low whisper. And Voiles said Terrence would contact me in a couple of weeks to see if I will cooperate. He said goodbye and walked away. And this was Tuesday? She asked. Yes, the first day. What did you do the rest of the week? I slept little, ate little, walked around with a dull headache most of the time. I think I feel one coming. I'm sorry, Abby. I wanted to fly home immediately and tell you. I've been in shock for 3 days.
I'm in shock now.
I'm not believing this, Mitch. This is like a bad dream, only much worse. And this is only the beginning. The FBI is dead serious. Why else would the director himself meet with me, an insignificant rookie lawyer from Memphis, in 15-degree weather on a concrete park bench? He's assigned 5 agents in Memphis and 3 in Washington, and he said they'll spend whatever it takes to get the firm. So if I keep my mouth shut, ignore them and go about my business of being a good and faithful member of Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, one day they'll show up with arrest warrants and haul everybody away. And if I choose to cooperate, you and I will leave Memphis in the dead of the night after I hand the firm to the feds, and we'll go off and live in Boise, Idaho, as Mr. and Mrs. Wilbur Gates. We'll have plenty of money, but we'll have to work to avoid suspicion. After my plastic surgery, I'll get a job driving a forklift in a warehouse, and you can work part-time at a daycare. We'll have 2, maybe 3 kids, and pray every night that people we've never met keep their mouths shut and forget about us.
we'll live every hour of every day in morbid fear of being discovered. That's perfect, Mitch. Just perfect. She was trying hard not to cry. He smiled and glanced around the room. We have a third option. We can walk out that door, buy two tickets to San Diego, sneak across the border and eat tortillas for the rest of our lives. Let's go. But they'd probably follow us. With my luck, Oliver Lambert will be waiting in Tijuana with a squad of goons. It won't work. Just the thought. What about Lamar? I don't know. He's been here 6 or 7 years, so he probably knows. Avery's a partner, so he's very much a part of the conspiracy. And Kay? Who knows? It's very likely none of the wives know. I've thought about it for 4 days, Abby, and it's a marvelous front. The firm looks exactly like it's supposed to look. They could fool anyone. I mean, how would you and I or any other prospective recruit even think of such an operation? It's perfect. Except, now the feds know about it. And now the feds expect you to do their dirty work. Why did they pick you, Mitch? There are 40 lawyers in the firm. Because I knew nothing about it. I was a sitting duck. The FBI is not sure when the partners spring the surprise on the associates, so they couldn't take a chance with anyone else. I happened to be the new guy, so they set the trap as soon as I passed the bar exam. Abby chewed her lip and held back tears. She looked blankly at the door across the dark room. "And they listen to everything we say," she said. "No, just every phone call and conversation around the house and in the cars. We're free to meet here or in most restaurants, and there's always the patio. But I suggest we move farther away from the sliding door. To be safe, we need to sneak behind the storage shed and whisper softly." "Are you trying to be funny?" "I hope not. This is no time for jokes. I'm so scared, angry, confused, mad as hell, and not sure where to turn. I'm afraid to speak in my own house. I watch every word I utter on the phone, even if it's a wrong number. Every time the phone rings, I jump and stare at it. And now this. You need another drink." "I need 10 drinks. Mitch grabbed her wrist and squeezed firmly. "Wait a minute. I see a familiar face. Don't look around." She held her breath. "Where?" "On the other side of the bar. Smile and look at me." Sitting on a bar stool and staring intently at the TV was a well-tanned blonde with a loud blue-and-white alpine sweater, fresh from the slopes. But Mitch had seen the tan and the blonde bangs and the blonde mustache somewhere in Washington. Mitch watched him carefully. The blue light from the tube illuminated his face. Mitch hid in the dark. The man lifted a bottle of beer, hesitated, then, there, shot a glance into the corner where the McDears huddled closely together. "Are you sure?" Abby asked through clenched teeth. "Yes. He was in Washington, but I can't place him. In fact, I saw him twice." "Is he one of them?" "How am I supposed to know?" "Let's get out of here." Mitch laid a 20 on the table, and they left the airport. Driving her Peugeot, he raced through the short-term parking lot, paid the attendant, and sped away toward Midtown. After 5 minutes of silence, she leaned across and whispered in his ear, "Can we talk?" He shook his head. "Well, how's the weather been while I was away?" Abby rolled her eyes and looked through the passenger window. "Cold," she said. "Chance of light snow tonight." It was below freezing the entire week in Washington.
Abby looked flabbergasted at this revelation. Any snow? She asked, with raised eyebrows and wide eyes as if enthralled with the conversation.
No, just raw cold.
What a coincidence. Cold here and cold there.
Mitch chuckled to himself. They rode silently on the interstate loop.
So who's going to win the Super Bowl? He asked.
Oilers.
Think so, huh?
I'm for the Redskins. That's all they talked about in Washington.
My, my. Must be a real fun city.
More silence. Abby placed the back of her hand over her mouth and concentrated on the taillights ahead. At this moment of bewilderment, she would take her chances in Tijuana. Her husband, number 3 in his class, at Harvard, the one with Wall Street firms rolling out the red carpet, the one who could have gone anywhere to any firm, had signed up with the mafia. With 5 dead lawyers notched on their belts, they most surely wouldn't hesitate with number 6. Her husband. Then the many conversations with Kay Quinn swirled around her brain. The firm encourages babies. The firm permits wives to work, but not forever. The firm hires no one with family money. The firm demands loyalty to the firm. The firm has the lowest turnover rate in the country. Small wonder. Mitch watched her carefully. 20 minutes after they left the airport, the Peugeot parked in the carport next to the BMW. They held hands and walked to the end of the driveway.
This is crazy, Mitch.
Yes. But it's real. It will not go away.
What do we do?
I don't know, babe. But we gotta do it quick. And we can't make mistakes.
I'm scared.
I'm terrified. Terrence did not wait long. 1 week after he waved goodbye to Mitch at the wall, he spotted him walking hurriedly in the cold in the direction of the federal building on North Main, 8 blocks from the Bendini building. He followed him for 2 blocks, then slid into a small coffee shop with a row of windows facing the street, or the mall, as it was called. Cars were prohibited on Main Street in Memphis. The asphalt had been covered with tile when the boulevard had ceased being a street and had been transformed into the Mid-America Mall. An occasional, useless and desolate tree rose from the tile and stretched its barren limbs between the buildings. Winos and urban nomads drifted aimlessly from one side of the mall to the other, begging for money and food. Terrence sat at a front window and watched in the distance as Mitch disappeared into the federal building. He ordered coffee and a chocolate donut. He checked his watch. It was 10 a.m. According to the docket, McDear had a brief hearing in tax court at this moment. It should be very brief, the clerk of the court had informed Terrence. He waited. Nothing is ever brief in court. An hour later, Terrence moved his face closer to the window and studied the scattered bodies walking quickly in the distance. He drained his coffee cup for the 3rd time, laid $2 on the table, and stood hidden in the door. As Mitch approached on the other side of the mall, Terrence moved swiftly toward him. Mitch saw him and slowed for a second.
Hello, Mitch. Mind if I walk with you?
Yes, I mind. Terrence. It's dangerous, don't you think? They walked briskly and did not look at each other.
Look at that store over there, Terrence said, pointing to their right. I need a pair of shoes.
They ducked into Don Pang's House of Shoes. Terrence walked to the rear of the narrow store and stopped between 2 rows of fake Reeboks at $4.99 for 2 pairs. Mitch followed him and picked up a pair of size 10s.
Don Pang or some other Korean eyed them suspiciously but said nothing. They watched the front door through the racks. "The director called me yesterday," Terence said without moving his lips. "He asked about you. Said it was time you made a decision."
"Tell him I'm still thinking."
"Have you told the boys at the office?"
"No. I'm still thinking."
"That's good. I don't think you should tell them."
He handed Mitch a business card.
"Keep this. There are two numbers on the back. Use either one from a payphone. You'll get a recorder, so just leave a message and tell me exactly when and where to meet you."
Mitch put the card in his pocket.
Suddenly, Terence ducked lower.
"What is it?" Mitch demanded.
"I think we've been caught.
I just saw a goon walk past the store and look in. Listen to me, Mitch, and listen carefully. Walk with me out of the store right now, and the instant we get out the door, yell at me to get lost and shove me away. I'll act like I want to fight, and you run in the direction of your office."
"You're going to get me killed, Terence."
"Just do as I say. As soon as you get to the office, report this incident to the partners. Tell them I cornered you and you got away as soon as possible."
Outside, Mitch shoved harder than necessary and yelled, "Get the hell away from me! And leave me alone!"
He ran two blocks to Union Avenue, then walked to the Bendini building. He stopped in the men's room on the first floor to catch his breath. He stared at himself in the mirror and breathed deeply 10 times. Avery was on the phone with two lights holding and blinking. A secretary sat on the sofa, ready with a steno pad for the onslaught of commands. Mitch looked at her and said, "Would you step outside, please? I need to speak with Avery in private." She stood, and Mitch escorted her to the door. He closed it. Avery watched him closely and hung up.
"What's going on?" he asked.
Mitch stood by the sofa. "The FBI just grabbed me as I was returning from tax court."
"Damn.
Who was it?"
"Same agent. Guy by the name of Terence."
Avery picked up the phone and kept talking.
"Where did it happen?"
"On the mall, north of Union. I was just walking alone, minding my own business."
"Is this the first contact since that other thing?"
"Yes. I didn't recognize the guy at first." Avery spoke into the receiver.
"This is Avery Toler. I need to speak to Oliver Lambert immediately."
"I don't care if he's on the phone. Interrupt him, and now."
"What's going on, Avery?" Mitch asked.
"Hello, Oliver. Avery here. Sorry for the interruption. Mitch McDear is here in my office. A few minutes ago, he was walking back from the federal building when an FBI agent approached him on the mall."
"What?"
"Yes, he just walked in my office and told me about it."
"All right. We'll be there in 5 minutes."
He hung up.
"Relax, Mitch. We've been through this before."
"I know, Avery, but this does not make sense.
Why would they bother with me? I'm the newest man in the firm."
"It's harassment, Mitch. Pure and simple. Nothing but harassment. Sit down." Mitch walked to the window and looked at the river in the distance. Avery was a cool liar. It was now time for the "they're just picking on us" routine.
"Relax, Mitch."
"Relax? With 8 FBI agents assigned to the firm and the director, Mr. Denton Voiles himself monitoring the case daily? Relax?" He'd just been caught whispering to an FBI agent inside a dollar shoe store, and now he was forced to act like he was an ignorant pawn being preyed upon by the evil forces of the federal government.
Harassment?
Then why was the goon following him on a routine walk to the courthouse? Answer that, Avery.
"You're scared, aren't you?" Avery asked as he put his arm around him and gazed out the window.
"Not really,"
Locke explained it all last time. I just wish they would leave me alone. It's a serious matter, Mitch. Don't take it lightly. Let's walk over and see Lambert. Mitch followed Avery around the corner and down the hall. A stranger in a black suit opened the door for them, then closed it. Lambert, Nathan Locke, and Royce McKnight stood near the small conference table. Again, a tape recorder sat on the table. Mitch sat across from it. Black eyes sat at the head of the table and glared at Mitch. He spoke with a menacing frown. There were no smiles in the room. Mitch, has Terrence or anyone else from the FBI contacted you since the first meeting last August?
No. Are you certain?
Mitch slapped the table.
Damn it, I said no! Why don't you put me under oath?
Locke was startled. They were all startled. A heavy, tense silence followed for 30 seconds. Mitch glared at Black Eyes, who retreated ever so slightly with a casual movement of his head. Lambert, ever the diplomat, the mediator, intervened.
Look, Mitch, we know this is frightening. Damn right it is. I don't like it at all. I'm minding my own business, working my ass off 90 hours a week, trying to be nothing but a good lawyer and member of this firm. And for some unknown reason, I keep getting these little visits from the FBI. Now, sir, I would like some answers.
Locke pressed the red button on the recorder.
We'll talk about that in a minute. First, you tell us everything that happened.
It's very simple, Mr. Locke. I walked to the federal building at 10 for an appearance before Judge Kofer on the Malcolm Delaney case. I was there about an hour, and I finished my business. I left the federal building, and I was walking in the direction of our office. In a hurry, I might add. It's about 20 degrees out there. A block or two north of Union, this guy Terrence came out of nowhere, grabbed my arm, and pushed me into a small store. I started to knock the hell out of him, but after all, he is an FBI agent, and I didn't want to make a scene. Inside, he tells me he wants to talk for a minute. I pulled away from him and ran to the door. He followed me, tried to grab me, and I shoved him away. And then I ran here, went straight to Avery's office, and here we are. That's all that was said. Play by play, everything.
What did he want to talk about?
I didn't give him a chance, Mr. Locke. I have no plans to talk to any FBI agent unless he has a subpoena.
Are you sure it's the same agent?
I think so. I didn't recognize him at first. I haven't seen him since last August. Once inside the store, he pulled his badge and gave me his name again. At that point, I ran.
Locke pressed another button and sat back in the chair. Lambert sat behind him and smiled ever so warmly.
Listen, Mitch, we explained this last time. These guys are getting bolder and bolder. Just last month they approached Jack Aldrich while he was eating lunch in a little grill on 2nd Street. We're not sure what they're up to, but Terrence is out of his mind. It's nothing but harassment.
Mitch watched his lips but heard little. As Lambert spoke, he thought of Kaczynski and Hodge and their pretty widows and children at the funerals.
Black Eyes cleared his throat. It's a serious matter, Mitch, but we have nothing to hide. They could better spend their time investigating our clients if they suspect wrongdoing. We're lawyers. We may represent people who flirt with the law, but we have done nothing wrong. This is very baffling to us.
Mitch smiled and opened his hands.
What do you want me to do? He asked sincerely.
There's nothing you can do, Mitch, said Lambert. Just stay away from this guy and run if you see him.
If he so much as looks at you, report it immediately.
That's what he did, Avery said defensively.
Mitch looked as pitiful as possible.
You can go, Mitch, Lambert said.
And keep us posted.
He left the office by himself. Devasher paced behind his desk and ignored the partners.
He's lying, I tell you. He's lying. The son of a bitch is lying. I know he's lying.
What did your man see? Asked Locke.
My man saw something different. Slightly different, but very different. He says McDear and Terrence walked sort of nonchalantly into the shoe store. No physical intimidation by Terrence, none at all. Terrence walks up, they talk, and both sort of duck into the store. My man says they disappear into the back of the store, and they're back there for 3, maybe 4 minutes. And then another one of our guys walks by the store, looks in, and sees nothing. Evidently, they saw our man, because within seconds, they come flying out of the store with McDear shoving and yelling.
Something ain't right, I tell you.
Did Terrence grab his arm and force him into the store? Nathan Locke asked slowly, precisely.
Hell no.
And that's the problem. McDear went voluntarily, and when he said the guy grabbed his arm, he's lying. My man says he thinks they would have stayed in there for a while if they hadn't seen us.
But you're not sure of that, Nathan Locke said.
I wasn't sure, damn it. They didn't invite me into the store.
Devasher kept pacing while the lawyers stared at the floor. He unwrapped a Roy Tan and crammed it into his fat mouth. Finally, Oliver Lambert spoke.
Look, Devasher, it's very possible McDear is telling the truth and your man got the wrong signals. It's very possible. I think McDear is entitled to the benefit of the doubt.
Devasher grunted and ignored this.
Do you know of any contact since last August? Asked Royce McKnight.
We don't know of any, but that doesn't mean they ain't talked, does it now? We didn't know about those other two until it was almost too late. It's impossible to watch every move they make. Impossible.
He walked back and forth by his credenza, obviously deep in thought.
I gotta talk to him, he finally said.
Who?
McDear. It's time he and I had a little talk.
About what? Lambert asked nervously.
You let me handle it, okay? Just stay out of my way.
I think it's a bit premature, Locke said.
And I don't give a damn what you think. If you clowns were in charge of security, you'd all be in prison.
Mitch sat in his office with the door closed and stared at the walls. A migraine was forming at the base of his skull, and he felt sick. There was a knock at the door.
Come in, he said softly.
Avery peeked inside, then walked to the desk.
How about lunch?
No, thanks. I'm not hungry.
The partner slid his hands into his trouser pockets and smiled warmly.
Look, Mitch, I know you're worried. Let's take a break. I've got to run downtown for a meeting. Why don't you meet me at the Manhattan Club at 1? We'll have a long lunch and talk things over. I've reserved the limo for you. I'll be waiting outside at 1:45.
Mitch managed a weak smile as if he was touched by this.
Sure, Avery.
Why not?
Good. I'll see you at 1.
At 1:45, Mitch opened the front door and walked to the limo. The driver opened the door and Mitch fell in. Company was waiting. A thick, bald-headed man with a huge, bulging, hanging neck sat smugly in the corner of the rear seat. He stuck out a hand.
Name's Devasher, Mitch. Nice to meet you.
Am I in the right limo? Mitch asked.
Sure, sure. Relax.
The driver pulled away from the curb.
What can I do for you? Mitch asked.
You can listen for a while. We need to have a little talk.
The driver turned on Riverside Drive and headed for the Hernando de Soto Bridge. Where are we going? Mitch asked.
For a little ride. Just relax, son.
So I'm number six, thought Mitch. This is it. No, wait a minute. They were much more creative than this with their killing.
Mitch, can I call you Mitch?
Sure.
Fine.
Mitch, I'm in charge of security for the firm, and why does the firm need security?
Just listen to me, son, and I'll explain.
The firm has an extensive security program, thanks to old man Bendini. He was a nut about security and secrecy. My job is to protect the firm, and quite frankly, we're very concerned about this FBI business.
So am I.
Yes. We believe the FBI is determined to infiltrate our firm in hopes of collecting information on certain clients.
Which clients?
Some high rollers with questionable tax shelters.
Mitch nodded and looked at the river below. They were now in Arkansas, with the Memphis skyline fading behind them.
Devasher recessed the conversation. He sat like a frog with his hands folded across the gut. Mitch waited until it became apparent that lapses in conversation and awkward silence did not bother Devasher. Several miles across the river, the driver left the interstate and found a rough county road that circled and ran back to the east. Then he turned onto a gravel road that went for a mile through low-lying bean fields next to the river. Memphis was suddenly visible again across the water.
Where are we going? Mitch asked, with some alarm.
Relax. I want to show you something.
A grave sight, thought Mitch. The limo stopped on a cliff that fell 10 feet to a sandbar next to the bank. The skyline stood impressively on the other side. The top of the Bendini building was visible.
Let's take a walk, Devasher said.
Where to? Mitch asked.
Come on. It's okay.
Devasher opened his door and walked to the rear bumper. Slowly, Mitch followed him.
As I was saying, Mitch, we are very troubled by this contact with the FBI. If you talk to them, they will get bolder. Then who knows what the fools will try. It's imperative that you not speak to them ever again.
Understand?
Yes. I've understood since the first visit in August.
Suddenly, Devasher was in his face, nose to nose. He smiled wickedly.
I have something that will keep you honest.
He reached in his sport coat and pulled out a manila envelope.
Take a look at these, he said with a sneer and walked away.
Mitch leaned on the limo and nervously opened the envelope. There were 4 photographs, black and white, 8x10, very clear. On the beach. The girl.
Oh my God, who took these? Mitch yelled at him. What difference does it make?
It's you, ain't it? There was no doubt about who it was. He ripped the photographs into small pieces and threw them in Devasher's direction.
We got plenty at the office, Devasher said calmly. Bunch of them.
We don't want to use them, but one more little conversation with Mr. Terrence or any other fibby and we'll mail them to your wife.
How would you like that, Mitch?
Imagine your pretty little wife going to the mailbox to get a red book and catalogs, and she sees this strange envelope addressed to her.
Try to think of that, Mitch.
The next time you and Terrence decide to shop for plastic shoes, think about us, Mitch, because we'll be watching.
Who knows about these? Mitch asked.
Me and the photographer. And now you. Nobody in the firm knows, and I don't plan to tell them. But if you screw up again, I suspect they'll be passing them around at lunch.
I play hardball, Mitch. He sat on the trunk and rubbed his temples. Devasher walked up next to him.
Listen, son. You're a very bright young man, and you're